This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week, I got to have a conversation with Josh Gerstein. He is Politico's senior legal affairs reporter. He covers the intersection of law and politics, including special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation of President Donald Trump and his associates, as well as ensuing counter-investigations into the origins of the FBI's initial inquiry into the Trump-Russia saga. Gerstein has spent more time in courtrooms and more time reading legal pleadings than many members of the bar. For more than a decade, he has taken Politico readers inside the most celebrated political trials of our era, involving figures like former Senator John Edwards, longtime Trump confidant Roger Stone, and former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort. I loved having this conversation with him about much of what we can expect from the second Trump administration. I learned a lot, and I hope that you do as well. Josh Gerstein, thank you so much for being here. I've read your work for a long time, and I'm really pleased to have this conversation with you. You're covering so much of the day-to-day of what is happening in the run-up to the second Trump administration. I'm hoping we can start by taking a step back and just asking, what are the really big legal stories that you think we all need to have our eyes on for the next, let's start just with the short term, maybe until the inauguration?
Until the inauguration, I mean, I think we're still all waiting to see exactly how the four criminal cases against former President Trump play out. It seems like most of them are going to fizzle out, but I think there's still a possibility for us to be surprised maybe by the one in New York where he was convicted several months ago. There's a possibility that the judge there might decide to proceed with the sentencing, in which case that would obviously be a hugely distracting event in the middle of the transition. And I could easily see Trump's lawyers trying to go all the way to the Supreme Court to try to block it. I think in terms of things that are happening before the transition, that would be one thing we're watching. Another thing would be pardons and commutations from President Biden. The last time Trump was in office, they made a real push to schedule a lot of executions, including during the weeks leading up to Trump leaving office the last time. Mm-hmm. And it would not at all surprise me. In fact, there's an effort underway to get President Biden to, at a minimum, commute the sentences of people that are already on federal death row, and perhaps to take more broad kind of commutation actions before he leaves. So I would say those are probably most of the things that we're watching for. And one other smaller thing might be, you know, other efforts in other departments across the government to try to lock in sort of Biden policies and make them difficult for Trump to change, either through regulations or other kinds of actions that presidents or their administrations will sometimes take when leaving office to try to make it a little bit more difficult for their successor to rapidly unwind the things that they've enacted.
That's interesting. I don't think I've thought enough about that. What are some specific examples of areas where you're looking at where the Biden administration or really any presidential administration could just, at the very least, try and put up some hurdles for the next administration to undo things?
Well, I mean, it's tricky to do it at this point. You know, some of it needed to be done already. Regulations and so forth, I think they sometimes refer to them as midnight regulations that are put through in the last couple months of an administration, I think can be unwound on Capitol Hill. But if you think about some of the things that happened last time with when Trump was in office, things, for example, like his effort to get rid of DACA, right. It was really something that he definitely had the power to do, but the courts ultimately decided that the way that they sought to unwind it wasn't legal, didn't meet the requirements of the law to do it, and sent them back to the drawing board. And that process of making that decision took several years, and it effectively preserved DACA through Trump's entire term. We saw that with census questions and so forth. So I don't have a lot of specifics that I can give you, but I would say areas like immigration, might you see Biden try to extend the status even further into the future of some of the people that are in the country on temporary status? If he issued an order, say, granting them another 12 months or something like that, would that be something that Trump could easily rescind? I don't know enough about the specifics, but I think those are things that are still being considered across the government. And I talked to a former Trump administration legal official just over the weekend, and you know, he was saying that they're going to need to be a lot more careful the way they do things, because at least the Supreme Court under the first Trump term was sometimes a stickler about following the crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's, and didn't like the way the Trump administration had done that work, felt it was too helter-skelter. And I am certain we're going to hear the same kinds of debates in the next four-year Trump administration.
The Administrative Procedures Act loomed large over those questions, as you mentioned, the trying to unwind DACA, the census. I think in both cases, as you pointed out, the Supreme Court saying, you can do it, just not this way. Let's fast forward to after the inauguration. And I know that you and I are both anticipating what the administration could do. There's so much to think about in terms of executive power. Obviously, I think probably there will be fewer executive orders than there otherwise would have been, because the Republicans achieved the trifecta of controlling the White House, the Senate, and the House. But are there two or three big legal stories that either you think we really need to keep our eyes on, and or that we haven't talked about enough yet?
Well, what I would say, Jessica, is like, even though the Republicans now will have both houses of Congress and the White House, Trump is pretty impatient a lot of the time. And he made all these promises on the campaign trail. I think the Washington Post cataloged, you know, maybe it was 100. I can't remember the exact number. Not just promises, but promises he made of things he was going to do, quote unquote, on day one, right? And It's going to be very difficult for him to do all those things. But to me, what it signals is he's never been a guy that's really particularly comfortable with the notion of waiting around to get Congress to officially sign off on something. And it remains unclear right now what margins the Republicans are going to have in the House. It looks like 53 votes in the Senate. In the House, it looks like, you know, it's going to be very close, like it was last time, and what kind of maneuvering that will cause. As far as we know at the moment, they have not signaled that they're going to dismantle the legislative filibuster. So I still think we're going to be looking at a lot of executive action and a lot of impatience on Trump's part to get it done. What areas is it going to be around? I mean, again, probably go look at the election and what issues he tried to raise. You're going to see a lot of urgent action around immigration, possibly have him declaring various states of emergency. It's not going to be that easy for him to find the funds or the people to do this kind of roundup that he wants to do of millions of undocumented immigrants. And so he's going to try to use his emergency powers to do that. Yeah. There's going to be an immediate flood of litigation. What other kinds of areas he's going to try on the very outset to challenge? Another big theme of the campaign is anti-DEI efforts. So we're going to see a real effort, I think, across the government to sort of locate every diversity committee that, you know, every tiny government agency may have, and rip it out root and branch. And so, you know, you may see some controversy. You'll certainly see controversy around that, and you may see some litigation around that as well. And I'm just sort of bracing for that first wave. I've already heard that there are various groups that have, you know, drafted legal challenges. And it reminds me quite a bit, I'm sure you'll remember, of the travel ban situation that went down about a week after Trump was sworn in 2017, and the sort of immediate physical and legal chaos that played out across the country as, you know, you had liberal activists rush to the airports to basically try to physically protect immigrants to the extent they could. And then you had the lawyers rush to the courthouses all across the country. And, you know, the reporters know that's going to happen again. The groups know that they're going to do that again. And the Trump administration has learned some lessons from 2017. And I think we'll be even more prepared to try to fight that wall of litigation that they're going to face in the days after January 20th, 2025.
That's such a good point about waiting for the legislative process, because as we know, that's not designed for speed, whereas the executive branch really is in a lot of ways. And it's helpful to think about where the Trump administration will try and potentially push the bounds of executive power, as you said, very likely invoking national emergency and trying to make good on the promise that he made on the campaign trail about immigration. I'd like to focus a little bit on one of the things you mentioned in terms of what we think about in the short term. And you mentioned the four criminal cases. And I'd like to talk about a recent piece that you wrote about the Georgia appeals court postponing Trump's arguments. So I'm hoping you could tell us where that case is and what the latest developments are.
So that case is the one, I'm going to be a little bit off on the numbers here, but I think at one point it had as many as 18 defendants or co-defendants along with Trump. And a few of those people pleaded guilty already. So maybe we're down to about 15. It's kind of a sprawling case. It's the one that comes out of Fulton County, basically charges Trump and the various other people in it with conspiring to, by illegal means, overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in Georgia in particular. And the issue that is on appeal at the moment is this definitely seems like a side issue to me that has to do with the prosecutor in that case, Fani Willis, the Fulton County District Attorney, and her relationship with what personal relationship with one of the prosecutors. This got a lot of news attention several months ago. There was an extended hearing in the trial court, and the judge ultimately said that either the other prosecutor or Fani Willis had to leave the case, but he wasn't going to shut down the case or kick her office off of it. And the other prosecutor stepped down, and Fani Willis has remained on the case. And the I think what happened is one of Trump's co-defendants took that issue to the Georgia Court of Appeals and asked them to dig into it and to basically put the case on hold. I think Trump joined in that appeal. And several months ago, the Georgia Court of Appeals said that they would hear that appeal. And it basically froze most, but not all the case. It froze the case against Trump and many of the other co-defendants, maybe not every single one. And so now we have sort of a double freeze. There were supposed to be arguments early next month in that Georgia Court of Appeals case. And now the Georgia Court of Appeals, apparently with no motion from anyone, as best my reporting can determine, just decided to pause those arguments indefinitely. My sense or guess is that what's going on is that they're probably going to ask the various sides in that case to address the implications of Trump now being the president-elect, because, you know, there are real constitutional questions about whether a state can put either a president-elect or more directly a president on trial in a criminal case while he or she is serving as president. And the court hasn't said that that's the reason they paused it. You know, maybe they had a scheduling conflict, but I think that's probably their reason. And I bet we see an order in the coming days asking both sides to address that issue, at least on paper. And there's a good chance that these arguments won't happen before Trump is inaugurated in January, which means there's a good chance that they won't happen for several years.
And this is such a helpful explanation. Of course, this is the state case that I viewed as, in some ways, the analog to the DC election interference case. It was, as you mentioned, put on hold because of what seemed like a side issue, which was potential conflicts of interest by the district attorney basically hiring her boyfriend, now former boyfriend, to be one of the lead attorneys on the case for a period of time. And Josh, I'm hoping that we could highlight for a minute what the constitutional arguments are, because right after the election, I think the most common question I got was, what happens to the criminal cases? And in the Georgia case, as you mentioned, on hold, they would still, as far as I understand, if they move forward, which I don't think they will, they would still have to apply the Supreme Court's immunity decision. But obviously, because this is a state prosecution, the president cannot pardon himself, pre-pardon himself. He doesn't have an attorney general who he can direct to drop a case. There's no special counsel that he can fire because it's a state prosecution. My understanding is that the constitutional argument, as you said, goes something along the lines of a state can't undermine the actions and constitutional duties of the chief executive to take care to faithfully execute the laws. And therefore, it would essentially be the state overstepping to put a president on trial and potentially lead to a conviction. Is that basically what we're all thinking about here?
Yeah, I think that sort of captures it. It's a little bit vague in the sense that a lot of these, this, I'll give a little bit of opinion here. Yeah. A lot of these protections for presidential power, to me, you see them coming up as being inferred from the text of the Constitution and the separation of powers and federalism and things like that. If people are looking to know what article and what section of the Constitution says that a president can't be prosecuted in state court while he or she is president, they're going to spend a long time looking for it because they're not going to find it. That said, you won't find the other immunity that the Supreme Court awarded to Trump and other presidents earlier this year. It's built on both past decisions talking about the need for sort of presidents to have maximum flexibility. Obviously, if you're in the process of being arrested by the Georgia Bureau of Investigation or something like that, you're not going to have the kind of flexibility that I think most of us would think the president of the United States should have. I think some of it is inferred from decisions that actually have gone against presidents in the past, like, for example, the one involving President Bill Clinton and Paula Jones's lawsuit against him, where the Supreme Court said, well, it's just a civil suit to have a deposition while you're president is really not that big a deal. We're confident the courts can manage this. I don't know if they explicitly said if it was criminal, that would be another matter. But a lot of people viewed that as kind of implicit in what they were saying. And so, that's basically, I think, the argument that it would be very difficult for a president to execute his duties sort of freely and in the way that the Supreme Court seems to think presidents should have the authority to do if he is dealing with everything that goes along with a criminal case, like a criminal trial. And so forth. I would just leave one footnote that they did say that, like, subpoenas and things like that related to a criminal case, possibly even briefly testifying, that might still be okay, because we had that sort of come up in connection with the New York case while he was still president, and the Supreme Court said some of that might be okay. But I just think, based on what we've seen in terms of the real appreciation that many of the members of the conservative Supreme Court majority have for executive power, they would not really countenance a state interfering in a president's activities and ability to carry out his office. And so I don't know if the states will persist in it, or they'll give up, or they'll voluntarily put these things on hold. But if they don't, I think the Supreme Court is likely to step in and do that.
Yeah, I think that's right, looking at the immunity decision. The Clinton v. Jones case is interesting because, as you said, it's a civil case, and it acknowledges, I think, both sides of the difference when it comes to a criminal case. On the one hand, it's much more burdensome for a president. On the other hand, there's much more of a public interest in the administration of justice. But I suspect that this court, being very protective of the executive, at least in the abstract, would not allow a state court criminal proceeding to go forward. And you mentioned something, Josh, that I thought was so interesting in the beginning about the New York case and the fact that the sentencing could continue. Of course, that's the only one of the criminal cases where it's gone to trial and there's been a conviction. And that case, I understand there was a pause on that case from Judge Mershon right after the election. And what he was going to rule on, I think, dealt with these issues of presidential immunity. But the sentencing, as I understand it, is still set for November 26. Do you think, is there a likely scenario here? Is it that there is a sentence, but it doesn't include any time behind bars? I can't imagine a sentence that's handed down that includes any jail time for a president-elect.
Yeah, I mean, I still think it's probably more likely than not that that will go away, that sentencing, and it maybe will just all be put off until after Trump leaves office. But if it does go forward, you're right. I mean, the judge, Judge Mershon, you know, I was up there for most of the trial, and he talked during the trial about the difficulties, not with putting a president, this was just with putting, at that time, a former president or a presidential candidate in jail. I'm sure you remember, Jessica, Trump kept running into issues of contempt with the gag order up there. He seemed to be violating on a regular basis and got a lot of stern warnings from the judge. But the judge said, you know, he kind of acknowledged that there was sort of a double standard here. And he almost said that, you know, if this was just an ordinary citizen that was defying the court's orders on a regular basis, that person would have been sent to jail. But the judge said he couldn't quite sort of visualize how that was going to work, given the need for the Secret Service and how the jail would operate. And, you know, with the other prisoners having somebody in there that was being guarded by the Secret Service. And there were all these questions that really are unprecedented or nearly unprecedented. And he just didn't want to have to cross that bridge. And the sentencing will raise all those kinds of questions. And so, you know, I guess it's possible Mershon will try to fashion a sentence, but it's going to seem like a weird undertaking when everybody in the courtroom sort of knows that Trump is never going to serve that or isn't going to serve that sentence anytime soon. So, you know, people may regard it as something of a joke or a footnote or something like that to see, you know, the notion that he gets 6 months in jail or something like that, but people will never expect him to serve it. So that's part of why if I was a betting person, I would probably say that this will not happen later this month. But, you know, then there's a legal issue there that you kind of alluded to that had hung up the case, which is the Supreme Court's immunity ruling. I was in court when I think a couple different people that were White House officials, sort of low-level administrative staff and so forth in the White House testified to a couple different things in the case. And so that has caused some complaints from the defense in retrospect that that shouldn't have happened because of the Supreme Court's immunity decision. It wasn't set up properly. Of course, the court and the prosecutors didn't have that guidance from the Supreme Right. Court at that time. So it might have been a harmless error, as the judges say, but it might not have been. It's certainly true that Judge Mershon didn't do that sort of analysis before allowing those people to testify. And so that's the legal issue that I think is sort of hanging this up at this point. And even if the judge ends up going forward with the sentence, that might be the main sticking point in any appeal that's filed that might continue to play out while Trump is in office.
It's really helpful to think about what's actually going to happen in that case. And then, of course, in the other cases, the other criminal cases, those are both federal cases. And I actually do have one question that I've been getting, and I would love to hear your take on this. We know that the president has the power to fire the special counsel. We know that the president has the power to say to his attorney general, you know, walk into court, file the papers, tell them that these prosecutions are ending. What is your reporting indicate with respect to whether or not a judge has any leeway to say, no, sorry, this case is continuing, or if there's essentially no discretion in the matter, and you say, okay, thank you, and the case is dismissed?
So, you know, I would say there's some argument out there that the judges have some discretion about whether to accept a government motion to dismiss a criminal case, a federal criminal case. We have lived through this already a couple years ago with Michael Flynn, where this issue came up. General Flynn had already entered a guilty plea, but hadn't been sentenced yet in that case when Attorney General Bill Barr announced that he was going to drop the case. And the judge that this was assigned to said that he wasn't entirely sure whether that was an issue that the judge had some discretion over or whether it was an automatic sort of thing. And he appointed a former federal judge from New York to sort of make the argument that judges do have some discretion in this area. So there's a possibility that the answer might be that judges have some discretion. On the other hand, I think the stronger argument is that when the executive branch says that they're done with a criminal case, and if the defense is willing to go along with that, that that's the end of the case, because otherwise you end up with a problem, which is who's going to prosecute this case?
Right.
I mean, are you going to order people from the Justice Department to prosecute the case? What if they just don't do a very, very good job of it on purpose? You know, I've in my career encountered a few instances where judges have basically appointed people to prosecute things. But the only times I know of that happening involve either like contempt of court type situation, or maybe it went on once or twice with, you know, alleged leaks of grand jury information. To have a prosecutor, the judge appoint a prosecutor to prosecute a very complex case with complex evidence that has some alleged classified information in it and all kinds of other sensitive information at issue, even this DC election case, I just think it seems like a morass. And and so I would say that it's very likely that if whoever Trump installs as attorney general, either as acting attorney general or gets confirmed as attorney general, announces that this case is being dismissed, I suspect that the judge will, Judge Chutkan, who's in charge of the case, will accept that. And even if she doesn't, I suspect the DC Circuit or the Supreme Court would say that that's basically the end of the matter.
I think that's right. So interesting, the number of questions where we've just never been here before legally. But you mentioned the Department of Justice, and I think this brings us to the last set of questions I have, which is actually just to talk to us a little bit about your reporting on what's happening in the Department of Justice. We know at the time we're recording this interview that former President Trump, future President Trump, has said that he is going to appoint Matt Gaetz to be the Attorney General. You have a recent article, and the title is, "You Thought DOJ Staffers Were in Full-Blown Freakout Before, ... So could you talk to us a little bit about what is happening in the Department of Justice?
Right. So it's a pretty tumultuous time over there at the moment. I was in the Justice Department on the morning after the election, and for the initial hours, it was very quiet. And then you had sort of emotional staffers roaming the hallways, going from office to office and clearly having conversations about the election. Now, we should make clear to people at home, there are two sets of people that work at the Justice Department, basically two different categories. There are the political appointees, which include both some high-level people and then some lower-level support staff. And then there are the career folks. And, you know, the career folks are supposed to be sort of apolitical. The political appointees are usually appointed by the president, maybe in some instances put in by the attorney general. And so those people, as a result of the election, are going to lose their jobs in, you know, I don't know how many days we have from this recording, but in about 2 months, they're going to be out of work. So you could understand, setting aside any other issues the election raised, that would be an issue of some concern. The career people are not going to be sort of instantly out of work, but basically as soon as Trump's victory was clear, there was a real wave of concern. Like, why was there such a nervousness? Well, part of it is Trump on the campaign trail is talking about prosecuting the special counsel Jack Smith and anybody who worked with him, prosecuting FBI agents that he thinks have done things that are improper, and the FBI is part of the Justice Department, bringing cases against his political enemies. Now, there are some people out there that are trying to dial back Trump's comments, but that seems to me like a hazardous profession to be in, because every time somebody tries to say, well, he's not really saying that he wants his political enemies prosecuted, he's just saying Justice Department should be even-handed. Very often within 24 hours of that, at least prior to the election, Trump would make quite clear, oh, no, I'm saying I want my political enemies prosecuted. So it's caused a great deal of angst within the department. And then, you know, you mentioned Trump's announcement that he's going to nominate Matt Gaetz to the representative or former representative from Florida to be attorney general. And that sort of turned the dials up to 11 on all of this because, you know, I think the people I've spoken to at the Justice Department, I've yet to find anybody that thinks that that's a serious nomination or that Gaetz would be in any way qualified to run the department. I think opinions differ about whether he's likely to be confirmed or not, but you'd have trouble finding, I think, many people at the Justice Department or the FBI that would regard him as a suitable leader for the department. Many of these people, you know, probably didn't hold some prior attorneys general in very high regard, but every one of them I spoke to made clear that this was just like an order of magnitude difference in trying to select someone like Matt Gaetz. And one other thing I would mention, Jessica, is there's also a lot of nervousness. Trump had talked about a program to replace a lot of the civil service, which is the career people that I was referring to earlier. And so there's nervousness about people feeling they're going to be asked to do things that are unethical, that there's going to be policies like the family separation policy that we saw last time that they're going to be asked to defend, and that if they sort of don't follow the marching orders, they might be fired, or maybe even a greater concern that they may just be shuffled off to a corner somewhere and basically given no substantive work for the remainder of Trump's presidency. So you hear all those types of concerns, as well as concerns on the part of some people that if they have had even a tangential involvement in Special Counsel Jack Smith's work or Special Counsel Robert Mueller's work on the Russia investigation, which Trump often railed at as president and thereafter, that they could be basically blackballed in the department and given menial tasks or no tasks for the remainder of the administration. So that's a lot for people to be concerned about. And that, I think, is contributing to this super tense atmosphere around the department.
Absolutely. I mean, we saw the Trump administration at the end of the first administration try to weaken civil service protection. I think you just laid out really carefully how important that is. They tried to implement something called Schedule F. Civil service protection, of course, is meant to ensure that government employees, and I think there are about 2.2 million who are subject to civil service protection now, are hired, promoted, and fired based on merit or lack of merit, not based on loyalty to the president or whether or not they worked on Robert Mueller's team or Jack Smith's team. So certainly it makes all the sense in the world that this is a particularly tense time at the Department of Justice. Josh, we're recording this episode pretty late at night for you, and you are going to be and have been very busy. So I'm extremely grateful for your time. It's been so informative. I really do rely on your reporting so heavily, and I'm so grateful that you were able to have this conversation.
Thanks so much, Jessica. The pleasure is mine.